I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the life of intrepid Texas political columnist Molly Ivins. Janice Engel will join us this hour. She's director of a new documentary that looks at how Ivins developed her strong progressive viewpoint and her sense of humor.
The first time I ever set foot on the floor of the Texas House of Representatives, I knew that this was reporter heaven. It was the beginning of a session, first day. People were slapping each other on the backs and slapping each other on the behinds and whispering. It's like first day of school. And I heard one old boy say to the other, "Hey, son, you should see what I found myself last night. And she don't talk, neither. I'm like, oh, this could be really interesting."
Our conversation starts after a short break. The late columnist Molly Ivins was not one to mince words.
The House Speaker is under grand jury investigation. And not that we wish him ill in any way, but it would be such a great renewal of a fine tradition. Five of our last seven have been indicted for one thing or another, and we kind of hate to let that one lapse. Actually, there was a guy in there who was not indicted. He was shot to death by his wife. Although she was indicted, she was not convicted. Because in Texas, we recognize public service when we see it.
Ivins was hard on Texas and America the way a great football coach is hard on players, because she loved them, she cared about them, and she was sure they could do better. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Molly Ivins grew up the daughter of an oil executive and attended Smith College, but she was deeply moved by the struggle for civil rights and had a deep affection for the folks she called Bubba and Bubette, salt-of-the-earth people who spoke the truth in a Texas drawl, which Ivins did, and were comfortable in their own skin, which Ivins seemed to be, but sometimes was not. Her career as a journalist took her to Minneapolis, New York City, Colorado, but she was happiest in her home state. And she was back here when she began writing her nationally syndicated column and best-selling books, which readers found either spot on and laugh out loud funny or rude and infuriating. But even her detractors could not seem to ignore what Molly Ivins had to say. Her big, bold, but sometimes lonely life is the subject of a fascinating new documentary directed by my guest, filmmaker Janice Engel. It's called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. Janice Engel joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin to talk about it. Janice, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. This is wonderful.
So it's not surprising to me to learn that Molly Ivins was a super smart kid who read all the time. It is surprising to find out she grew up in a fancy neighborhood in Houston, went to elite private schools. She was not raised to be an iconoclast.
No, she definitely was not. She was raised to be a debutante. As my producing partner, Carla Vandervoort, who grew up the same way, says, high wasp. You know, parties, debutante balls, and, you know, being the pretty girl, ready to get married and have children.
And her mother went around saying that her sister was the pretty daughter and Molly was the smart daughter, which seems like an ideal way to give two daughters a complex.
And it did. Her Molly's brother-in-law, Marty, points that out. They both had, you know, they grew up thinking, Molly grew up thinking that, you know, she was ugly and Sarah grew up thinking she was dumb. And that played out through their lives.
So how did Molly Ivins make herself aware of the civil rights struggle growing up in River Oaks in like the 1950s and 60s, where unless you deliberately looked for that sort of thing, you could have been sort of isolated from it?
Well, Molly liked to say that, you know, if you grew up during the civil rights era, which she did, you knew that people were lying to you. And who are those people? Those are the people who are in charge. Those are your parents, those in authority. And it was because it was obvious. You know, you would go to the local swimming hole and there was the section for the black kids and the section for the white kids. Or even closer is the water fountains. You know, you were told not to drink from that fountain. And as she pointed out, the water fountains of little kids were, the white fountain was filled with chewing gum and it was a mess. And the black fountain was very clean and spotless. So it didn't make sense. So you started to put, if you were, I think, an aware child, which she was a bookworm. She was called the mole. The mole was in her hole reading her books. She observed. She was pretty aware. And It didn't match. It didn't, you know, fit. It didn't match up.
How often did this sort of thing come up across the dinner table?
I think that, well, her father was chief counsel for Tenneco Inc. He was a man on the rise. He was the patriarch. He was the president of his fraternity post, you know, law school for years and years and years. And, you know, it was expected to have, you know, when he came home from work, dinner was to be on the table, a three-course meal. It started with cocktails. And as Molly pointed out, you know, after two to three, the sniping would begin. But he ruled the ship. You know, he was a yachtsman. Mm. He had sailed around the world on boats. And there was even a picture of him, and I think it was Sports Illustrated or something to that effect on the cover. And so she dubbed him early on the general, and it stuck.
So was he angry with her for her politics?
I think so. I think Molly really started to become political probably in her late teens because of the civil rights movement. And also because she just never fit in. And she was such a voracious reader. She went to school in Paris when she was 14 or 15. Her whole world opened up and she saw things. And she was an outsider. She was always for the underdog. And so she would point it out and she would always get into fights with her father at the dinner table where basically it was decided they would not talk politics. You know, her sister went along to get along and her brother Andy was the boy. So he was privileged. I mean, he even said, my sister's got a pass that I never did. He was given all the credit cards. His father played for everything because he was the boy. But he said, my sister's really never got a pass, and Molly especially.
So Molly Ivins goes off to Smith College. She says she didn't fit in. And yet, when she graduated and she takes her first job, I guess, at the Houston Chronicle, all of her colleagues thought she carried herself like Jackie Kennedy.
She was beautiful. I know people see Molly when she was 6 feet tall and she was overweight and she smoked like a chimney and she, you know, she ate and she drank and she, you know, she got big, but she was absolutely stunning. And Terry O'Rourke, who's one of her early boyfriends, he is the district attorney, second, I think, DA of Harris County, was her boyfriend. And he describes her as smart and as brilliant and as beautiful as Jackie Kennedy. She was really beautiful. And as smart as a whip.
It's interesting to say that she dated an assistant DA because throughout her later life, she felt like it was hard to find people to date because they were all colleagues or sources or subjects.
Well, that's true. But back when they were at the Houston Chron, he was a journalist. He was on a desk. He went off to be a congressional aide really early on. So he wasn't even yet had gone to law school. So they were all in the trenches. And Carlton Carl, they were all in the trenches as interns at the Houston Chron. But yeah, she made that joke that you basically, you know, you don't, you, what's the expression? You don't poop where you eat.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't do that. So, you know, Molly, here's the thing. I was in her archives. I lived in the Briscoe Center for American Studies at UT. At different points over the past 7 years, kind of going through her life. Her papers are there. And she had men, she had lovers, but unless I talk to them, it's really none of anybody's business. And Sarah Spite says that. I don't think that's really anybody's business, but she had lots of men who loved her, who wanted to be with her, but the people that maybe she wanted to be with weren't available.
Hmm.
But and I think she was also, her focus was on her career and how she could make a difference. I think it was really about her wanting to help people.
So after grad school, she goes to work for the Minneapolis Tribune and was covering a lot of race rallies. It's worth pointing out that at the moment she was starting her career in the mid to late 60s, they didn't often send women to sort of controversial assignments like that.
Well, that's interesting. You know, and talking to several of her colleagues and her friends who also came up as she did as women in journalism, you know, women were relegated to the snake pit, which was back then, that's what it was called, food, fluff, fashion, gardening, lifestyle.
Hmm.
And Molly was a 6 foot tall. I mean, she was just, she wasn't having it. And as she said, no one ever said, oh, you poor dainty little thing, get your, you know, it was always Ivan, get your ass out there. So when she went to Minneapolis, the reason she took that job is because they were going to give her a job as a reporter with a beat. So did her friend Marilyn Hogemeyer. That's why they all landed there, because the Min Trib was open to that. And there was maybe one or two other newspapers in the United States that were open to women being reporters. And because she had a master's degree from the Columbia J School, School of Journalism, she went there. So she was given the police beat, and she was the first woman reporter to have that gig. That's pretty amazing.
It's interesting to hear her say in the film that she became a writer because it was the only thing she was ever good at. I look at her and hear her and think she could have been good at anything she wanted to do.
I think at the time when she came up, there weren't a lot of choices for women. And she always felt that was the thing that came easiest to her. She was an outsider. You know, she didn't fit in. So she was going to go for what she enjoyed. And she enjoyed and loved writing. She enjoyed and was a massive bookworm. So it just seemed, like she said, she fell naturally backwards into journalism.
So at the Minneapolis Tribune, her editors did worry that she was getting too close to the sort of radical people she was covering at these race rallies. What was her response to accusations that she was not objective?
Oh, I feel the same way. She really stuck in her craw about the whole idea of objectivity and subjectivity. How you were born and how you grow up really forms who you are. And the notion that you can truly be objective is just a notion. You know, how you stand and where you live is really how you look at things. Now, you can try in a true fashion. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'm also a professor. That you can try to have, you know, you don't want to do bias, which then becomes propaganda. You want to present all sides of the story to get a full picture of it. But that doesn't mean you have to agree with it. You can let people say who they are and where they're at. You can give them that fair shake. But you know, she knew she couldn't do that kind of writing. She had an opinion and she wanted it to be known. So she felt very constrained by the idea in journalism, you know, you have to basically, you know, be truly and fully objective. Nobody is truly and fully objective. As I tell my students, you know, once you decide where you're placing the camera, are you objective? Hmm. Once you have all that footage and you look at it and you decide what you're going to edit, are you being objective? Or is there some subjectivity that comes into it? There always does, but you can be fair by presenting both sides of the story or several sides of the story. And as she said, I let my readers know where I stand, and they can take that with a grain of salt or a pound of salt, depending on where they're from. They can love her or hate her.
Yeah, how bothered was she by the fact that some people hated her?
You know, I think that Molly let it roll off of her. I think it sometimes would get to her, but I didn't know her personally, but in all the stuff I read that she wrote and her friends and her colleagues, she knew you had to have a thick skin. As far as she was concerned, she was after the truth. And that was the most important thing. If somebody is behaving stupidly, she was going to point it out. She was going to use humor to point it out, but she was going to point it out.
It's funny to think that, you know, she covered lawmakers pretty relentlessly. She did not let them get away with anything she considered bad behavior. At least in terms of the Texas legislature, they didn't seem to despise her for it, despite the fact that she pointed out a lot of mistakes they made.
They loved her for it. If she wrote about you, it meant you were worth writing about. Huh. You know, she says, you know, I would say something about a lawmaker at the ledge, you know, he has the brain or the mind of an adolescent peasant, and they'd see her the next day in the Capitol and they'd say, "Baby, you put my name in your paper." They loved it because, you know, look, you know, attention, good, bad, or indifferent. Bad publicity is as good as good publicity. You're getting mentioned.
And she must have known that they felt that way about her. And did she use it to her advantage, the fact that they wanted her to write about them?
Absolutely. She played that card high and large.
My guest is filmmaker Janice Engel. She directed a new documentary called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
The reason, of course, people run negative ads is because they work. Consultants have known that for a long time, and so has every demagogue who ever lived. You can win campaigns by appealing to people's prejudices and their fears. It works. But I remember one time interviewing an old boy out of West Texas. We were talking about the state of the world, and he said, you know, I feel like I'm about equal parts good and bad. There's just nobody appealing to the good in me. And sometimes I think that if campaign consultants and politicians would figure out that you can also win by appealing to the good in people, we'd all be a lot better off and we'd have a lot healthier politics.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was Molly Ivins speaking at Tulane University in 2004. My guest this hour is the director of a new documentary about Ivins, Janice Engel. The doc is called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. One thing, Janice, that I think is really interesting about Molly Ivins is that we know her as this sort of raconteur and this person who knew everything about politics and had these really incisive opinions, but she was dismayed by the fact that sometimes it was a mess and sometimes public servants got in their own way and in the way of the people they meant to serve.
Yeah, I mean, I loved hearing the bit of her Tulane speech you just had on. That ended up on the cutting room floor. I only could put in so much. She definitely, she said, you know, politics, democracy is messy, beloveds. You have to relish, you know, has certain confusion to it. You have to relish it. That's how life is. It's not all easy. And, you know, I think her overriding message, and it's in the film, is that, you know, it's up to us. You know, it's we the people. We have to do the heavy lifting. I mean, she was a First Amendment warrior. She said, you know, it's never going to be easy. You have to really pay attention and you have to care. You have to care. Politics is the warp and woof of our lives. Where you send your kids to school, the roads that are built. Every aspect, you don't realize how much has been regulated by the government that we created, this democracy. Yes, it's a republic. I know that's going on right now, republic versus democracy. Oh, my God. We're a democracy. And you know, it's very frustrating. You know, people, Molly's big thing was, you know, don't, you know, politics is not a picture on a wall. You know, people get apathetic. They're bored. They feel they can't make a difference. They can't make change. It's out of their hands. They have too much thinking, too much things going on in their lives. It is our responsibility. Somebody's not going to fix it for us. Some big daddy is not going to come and fix it for us. Hello. And that was her. That was a big message. It's up to us to do the heavy lifting. And everyone needs to take part in their civic responsibility and vote.
So she went to the Texas Observer, which is headquartered in Austin. It's a pretty, was and is, I think, a relatively small operation. But this was the time in her life she was really, really happy professionally.
Oh, she loved it. She said, I fifth my salary, you know. And I went to work at a funny little one-horse, you know, newspaper, the Texas Observer, which at that time was probably the only liberal paper in the South, much less the United States. And the mantle was given to two women in their early 20s. Kay Northcott and Molly Ivins co-edited the Texas Observer. And it was, as she called it, the best, you know, journalism school she could have ever have gone to, Ronnie Ducker's Texas Observer. You know, she got to cut her teeth. She got to write what she wanted. And she got to find her voice.
She was honing her humor and the way that she wielded it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she covered the ledge. And, you know, Molly had such a keen eye of observation. And she saw total stupidity. And she went after it. And it became the basis of a lot of her humor.
So those years also included lots of, like, beer drinking with the people she was covering and in the same places. It seems like she was aware early on of the hold that alcohol had on her, but not really motivated to change.
No, exactly. Well, you know, drinking, the culture of drinking is what she grew up in. You know, her family, having cocktails with dinner, you know, that sort of thing. And also Texas beer, you know, it's just part of the culture. And then when she got to the ledge, you know, the entree into the good old boys club was she could basically, you know, go belly to belly, toe to toe, and drink most of the guys under the table. I mean, she probably could drink them all under the table. She was 6 foot tall. She was big boned, and she could knock it back and remember everything they said to her. In fact, I mean, it didn't make it in the cut, but several of her friends and colleagues said it was amazing how much she could, you know, hold, remember everything, even just maybe making some notes on napkins and write, you know, a full column or a full story the next morning.
It's impressive.
It's very impressive.
She and Ann Richards got to be good friends before Richards became governor of Texas. What did they have in common?
So that's a great story. And some of it, you know, I have all this stuff about how that hall all started, the little pocket of liberals who basically hung out at the old Texas Observer offices on 7th and Nueces. I think that the place is still there. I filmed it. And the Texas Observer was upstairs where the balcony was, and downstairs was Dave Richards' law office. And they were always doing civil liberties and those types of cases. And they all became buddies. And so any, you know, when you're a liberal, as Cecile Richards, Ann Richards and Dave Richards' daughter, and the former president of Planned Parenthood and now running the supermajority, is in our film. And she said, you know, it was, if you were a liberal in Texas, you didn't win a lot, but you sure knew how to party and get together and laugh and have a good time. And everybody who was coming through, passing through Austin would stop by the TO offices, and cocktails would start about 4, which was beer. Mm-hmm. And they would all just drink and have a good old time. And they all, this posse of people became great friends, and they would have camping trips. And those camping trips are legendary. And Ann Richards was married to Dave Richards. She hadn't run for politics. She worked in local politics. She eventually, I think, ran for the state commission. She was the commissioner of, I'm forgetting what it was, but she, that's how she got into it. But she was the one who organized all the camping trips and barbecues and picnics. And there's, in Molly's papers, there's these hand-drawn maps to how to get to the campsite. And I asked Cecile, was like, you know, an adolescent and a teenager at that time. And I said, what was it like for the kids? She said, oh my God, all the adults were off, you know, partying and drinking, and we were left to our own devices. And she said it was heaven because they would canoe, they were out on a lake, the kids were left alone, and everybody felt very safe. But it was a really interesting time of community, of where you had to stick together, you know, and learn to laugh through all the losses, which were many.
So it seems really hard. I can't imagine as a journalist having to cover someone who is a dear friend and drinking buddy and camping buddy once that person gained a certain amount of power. Did it change their relationship?
Well, you know, Molly talks about that. And, you know, she said, I already knew Anne. It wasn't my fault she became governor. she had to, Molly's been criticized for it and praised for it. Some criticized her that she didn't cover Anne enough, and others said she covered her and she went after her. Molly said she took a step back, and she said while she was governor that they barely spoke. I mean, there's letters to each other, notes, but I think there was a distance. It was also at a time where, at that time, Anne and Dave had broken up, and Anne got sober, and Molly didn't. Mm. And, you know, both of them used to joke that they went to drunk school. That was the culture. You know, you would drink, you would tie one over. Molly knew she, like you had asked me earlier, she knew she had a drinking problem. And I found a little journal entry of when she was 29 years old. And it's a much longer entry than what's in the film. But she wanted to change right before she was turning 30. It was her 29th birthday. She wanted to change. But she, as Sarah Spites so, you know, aptly says, she wanted some things more. Hmm. And her career was really important to her. And being a part of the scene and having entree into the secrets of the good old boy club, because that entree allowed her to really dive in and hear the real stupidity and the threat to people of what was going on.
All right, I do want to talk about the time she spent at the New York Times. She probably wrote the most unique coverage of Elvis Presley's funeral while at the Times that was written by anybody. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
So that's a great story. She had just come to work for the Times, and Elvis died unexpectedly. And the New York Times, their music section was really very highbrow, and they didn't have anyone who knew about Elvis Presley's music, which to me is rather astonishing being a New Yorker. But they looked, and they looked across the, she says, a sea of reporters. And her descriptions of how she talks is how she writes. It's just so clever and brilliant. But they spotted, you know, Ivins, she talks funny. She'll know about Mr. Presley. So she wrote the obit, and they sold more newspapers than I think ever, even more than when JFK died. And so then when the funeral happened, the memorial, she got that assignment and they sent her out there. Now, what didn't make it in the film and what was in her article of covering the memorial and the funeral was the same weekend there was a Shriners convention as well as a United States cheerleading competition all converged on Memphis at the same time.
Wow.
And as Molly said, what a scene it was. And she captured it, the Shriners in their little beanie caps, drunk and on tricycles going down hallways and in the hotel where she was staying, and cheerleaders with their batons and doing their cheers and running down, I mean, and people sobbing. And she paints a picture that is absolutely a pure shot of Americana with a wonderful warm heart and tremendous humor.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, for people, Janice, maybe who are too young to have read Molly Ivins at her prime, she would make fun of people. She certainly had a sense of humor about American culture, Texas culture in particular. But the target of her humor was never just ordinary people being themselves.
No, in fact, she was asked that a lot about satire. You know, you use satire to bring, you know, to basically, you know, it's wit and it's cutting. And it's to bring down the people who are, you know, in position to be brought down. And she felt that when you use satire to go after regular folk who haven't taken that public position, she thought it was vulgar and cruel. For instance, the type of humor that Rush Limbaugh does, where he goes after innocent people. That's just nasty. And she pointed it out, and it is nasty, you know, making fun of people who have less ability or are, you know, just regular citizens. That's just mean. That's bullying. And Molly hated that. And she went after Rush a number of times. You know, she went after public figures. You got elected. You're in the public eye. You're ripe. You're a ripe target.
See, my theory is I only make fun of politicians and they all volunteer to stand in a free fire zone.
Uh-huh.
And it's not my fault.
So it's worth pointing out that the New York Times didn't quite know what to do with her. And ultimately, she would look at it as being exiled to their Colorado bureau.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, she that was a great relief for her. As she said, you know, to work for the New York Times, the best way to work is to be 1,000 miles away. She was relegated to what she was called the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief. She was the chief and the bureau. And she covered 9 states from the Canadian border to the Mexican border. And she, you know, and she loved it. And she had a couple of stringers that she worked with, and she would write pieces back. But every time she wrote in her voice, which is her, her Texas voice, what they hired her for, you know, the icon, her colloquialisms, the editorial staff of the New York Times would New York Times it. And they would take out all her humor completely and make it flat.
But didn't they hire her knowing how she wrote?
Yeah, they hired her for her voice, and she got fired for her voice.
Hmm.
She was always the consummate outsider. She couldn't fit.
I have to ask you how much her speaking voice was genuine to her and how much it was an affectation. She certainly, I have to imagine, at Smith College and at the private school she attended in Houston, was not encouraged to speak with quite the same drawl we knew from her later in life.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Molly was brought up high WASP. Mm-hmm. She went to Smith. She was schooled in Paris. Lou Dubose said she spoke Smith College English, fluent French, and Texan, which she appropriated from these gargoyles who were running the state, all men. And she appropriated it. And she became a good old girl. And she also, you know, looked to John Henry Falk. Mm. The late John Henry Falk was her mentor. He broke the blacklist. He sued and broke the blacklist. It's an amazing story in itself. And so he was her mentor, and he was this very, you know, it's in the Will Rogers vein, very folksy, it's very Texan, the long-winded story with humor in order to make a point. And she learned at his knee doing that, and that became what her friends called the professional Texan. They had there's the professional Texan, and then there was the private Molly.
She was so bold and funny in her writing. In her public speaking, she seems so comfortable. It's hard to imagine her ever feeling less than like entirely self-confident. Many people who knew her well describe her as like secretly shy, not always feeling so great about herself.
Yeah, Molly was, she had the professional Texan. How do you turn that off? And of course, when she became really, really famous, it's hard. And yet, you know, she wasn't married. She was a writer. It's a very solitary career and vocation. And there is an amount of loneliness. And she was an alcoholic, a very high functioning one. And, I think her issues, she went to drunk school, she would clean out, she would stop smoking, she would lose weight. She was always fighting her weight. She never, the thing that, her mother said, Molly's my smart one. She never felt that she was pretty. She used to make fun, as a Clydesdale amongst thoroughbreds. She made fun of herself. But that hurt, and that was in there. The one thing, and the last question you asked me, what I was going to say was, Molly, when she would get serious, she would use the professional Texan voice to tell her story or to pull you in. Mm-hmm. And then when she would get, as she'd say, I'm as serious as a stroke about this, the voice would change. And it would become the Texan would be gone. And the political wonk would set in. And it was East Coast. It was New York, not quite New York, but that East Coast smart, like when she said, it's not a left to right issue, it's a top to bottom issue. And then she would go, it's about who's getting screwed and who's doing the screw in, and would get a little bit back with the Texan. But she bridged that. So I just wanted to point that out about that. But yeah, she was she was lonely, and she was a high functioning alcoholic. And eventually those things overpower.
My guest is director Janice Engel. We're talking about her new documentary, Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
The reason you gotta have fun is because, as that great philosopher Jimmy Buffett says, if we couldn't laugh, we would all go insane. The reason you have to look for ways to make politics fun is it's better for your health, and it will keep you from becoming disgusted, cynical, bitter, and burned out.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Janice Engel, director of a new documentary called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. Was it exhausting to always be on once she did become famous? I mean, how did she sort of bring it every time she went on Letterman or gave a speech or a graduation address, that sort of thing?
Well, I think that's hard for anybody. I mean, I'm finding it myself. I've been doing this since January, the film came out. Of course, it gets wearing on someone. And I think, you see it in Molly, having gone through and found so many nuggets and so many few rare nuggets, but all the C-SPAN and all the different talk shows and the late night and the college, the speeches. And she donated a free speech every month for the ACLU on a promise to John Henry Falk on his deathbed in 1989 until pretty much she died. Every month, even when she couldn't do it, she would somehow get a message to some little, and it wasn't like New York or LA, it was some little small group of the 3 or 4 or 5 liberals who meet in the basement of the library. But she of course, I think it wore on her. And if you see a lot of times, as I have looked through so many of her things, her stories are repeated. She gets one good story, she'll tell it over and over. So it's like, which one am I going to use? Which one had the best audience reaction? Her shtick became her shtick. And she did it over and over again. Sometimes she would bring in something new. But when, like, for instance, when Bush got elected, then she had a new target. She wrote 2 books about him. And then we went to war. in Iraq. And, you know, her columns in those days, they were always brilliant and incredibly prescient. And I about the Iraq War, she was incredibly prescient. And at a time where it was not cool, unless you were patriotic, Molly spoke out. Paul Krugman said she was one of the most courageous women I've ever known. And she pointed it out way before those words, quagmire, three-way civil war, ever came to be. That took a couple of years. But she was talking about in 2002 and 2003.
Another prescient thing that we found in sort of just going through Molly Ivan stuff was this. She sort of understood the internet better than anybody at the time.
With the internet, information goes like that, instantly, all over the world, to everybody. The drawback, of course, is that there are no gatekeepers. There is nobody making sure that the information on the internet is accurate, factually accurate. And it pains me as a journalist to see some of the results, because I think that when you put bad information into the public debate, it's like poisoning the well of democracy.
Why was nobody listening to Molly Ivins in 2004?
Wow. Yes, that's another nugget that ended up on the cutting room floor. It was in one of my string outs. Wow. Talk about prescient. That's why we are in the place we're in right now. Hmm. And the whole idea of fake news. And the well has been sufficiently poisoned.
So when Molly Ivins was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of breast cancer, she was sort of characteristically sanguine about it. She made jokes about it, but her friends were really worried she wouldn't focus enough on taking care of herself.
And that's absolutely true. In fact, the reason she was diagnosed with breast cancer initially is because she did not get her mammogram for 3 or 4 years because she was so immersed in her career and her moving around and doing that she didn't get a mammogram for 4 years or something to that effect. That's why she did that thing, you know, with a period after each word, go get the damn mammogram, get it done now. Her friends were very worried that she wouldn't take care of herself, and rightfully so. She didn't. She did not take care of herself. She would for moments, and then she would fall back into bad habits. And as they, you know, Kay Northcott said, and several others said, but I used Kay, said, you know, Molly was afraid that if she didn't drink, she wouldn't be funny anymore. And when her friends, you know, asked her, you know, what are you drinking? What are you smoking? You have cancer. She says, like, what? I'm going to give up the only two things I enjoy. Hmm. Are you crazy? Which is interesting for where she ended up in terms of her life, but which is a whole other story.
Ultimately, her friends staged an intervention.
Yes, they did, because they had to. She was in a really bad way. She had had several deaths in her family, one of which I illustrate in the documentary and one I don't, as a promise to her sister-in-law. But that really, 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 really ripped her up. And she was drinking more and telling everybody she was drinking less. And then she embarrassed herself at a big fundraiser in Dallas when she basically spoke out to Nancy Pelosi in a way that probably should have been done in private. Mm-hmm. And on the way home, she was wildly drunk. And on the way home, she asked them to pull over and nobody would go in and buy her a six-pack of beer. So she went and bought it herself. And it just was bad. So they knew they had to do an intervention, which they did. And she knew it was coming. And she agreed. She said they opened the door. She says, this looks like an intervention. And she went off to detox and a rehab and came out and like a week or two later found out that the cancer had returned and it was a death sentence. And the most amazing thing about that, as Annie Lamott says, is that she said, Molly's the most courageous person I've ever known, because she was given a death sentence. And as she would have said earlier, as she did in her life, well, what? You know, give it up now. Molly decided that she was going to go out sober. And so she kept her sobriety. She went out, basically the gal who could speak truth to power to anyone, faced her own truth. And she went out clear-headed and wide-eyed and accepting. And she told her brother that before she died, that at the memorial, the thing that she wanted all her colleagues and her beloveds and her friends to know, the thing she was most proud of, was that she got sober in the last 18 months to 2 years of her life.
Wow. It is very moving, because the nature of a film like this is that you're going to move about somewhat in time, but we definitely see her physically diminished over time toward the end of her life. I was so touched by her guts. At one point, she received an award. She's completely bald, and she goes out there and doesn't make excuses for it. She is who she is. She's had chemo, and she's going to be out in public.
I know. Well, that's Molly. Molly was unabashed. She did, you know, it was like, this is who I am, warts and all. But I'm still going to do what I need to do, which is I'm still going to speak truth to power. I'm still going to give voice to those that don't have them. And I'm going to try to invigorate you all to do what you're supposed to do, which is take responsibility and care about our country, care about our democracy, care about each other. She never stopped raising hell.
Did she acknowledge in her writing, in her columns, the cancer and the fact that she was dying? Was it a frequent subject for her?
I don't know if it was frequent, but she definitely acknowledged. She did write a column to her beloveds that I've got a really virulent form of breast cancer and it's come back. Mm-hmm. So, yes, she did.
The idea that someone like Molly Ivins could sort of emerge and say what she wanted and believed and have people read her who loved her, but also people read her who hated her. Even that seems like a foreign concept today.
Well, we're so polarized. Isn't that what they want? They don't want us to talk to each other. Because if we do talk to each other, we might find the common ground, you know? And Molly knew that. So that she was a great unifier, I believe. And right now, and she kind of railed against the media silos, which started back when they, you know, the corporatization of media and the buying up of newspapers, eventually putting them, you know, out of business, even if they were doing a good business, because it was about, you know, the corporatocracy or the corporate oligarchy that we find ourselves in. So even though, you know, everybody tunes into whatever network they're going to tune into, it's all about the bottom line and who's getting the ratings. Mm. And they're all silos, but they're it's like you're preaching to the choir. You're not hearing a different point of view. And Molly was all about us coming together and finding the common ground to not be siloed.
What is the process like of going through how many hundreds of hours of videotape are there of Ivins' speeches and TV appearances?
Well, there's a lot. There's a lot to go through. But there's also all the interviews that I did.
Right.
I did over 45, and not all everybody makes the cut. People, the expression in the editing room is "kill your babies." It's a terrible expression, but it's so true. You know, you have to leave things on the cutting room floor. And some interviews are great, and some are not so great. But each one leads to maybe another one or something. You know, it's like you're a detective. And I'm doing a deep dive into her archives, which also becomes an archaeological dig. Hmm. And as I unearth things and I find things, it leads to something else. So I had hundreds of hours of material between Molly and her friends and her colleagues and politicians and all of those I had transcribed. And then I call it the culling process. And for 5.5 years, I edited myself. I culled everything down to bring on Monique Zavistovsky to help me finish the film and edit it with me because it was just too much. And I needed distance. So it's a huge process, especially in documentaries. You really write it in the post-production phase. You don't know it's not like writing a script with exposition and dialogue and characters. You have all the characters. You kind of have an idea of the structure or the storyline you might want to tell. But as you interview people or you shoot, film certain things, moments happen, things take a change, and suddenly you have a different trajectory. So you're not sticking to a script. And in a way, it's very exciting because your story really takes shape in the post-production process.
Molly Ivins could see through the nonsense of so much political talk. She could see, you know, the actual message behind the speeches that politicians made and the statements they made. What's so interesting to me is that she didn't quite realize how much people loved her. She didn't quite understand how attractive she was and how much people wanted her around. She was in, we'd have to call it denial for some time, at least about the importance of getting sober until the very end. Did she know herself as well as she understood Texan and American politics?
I think that Yeah, I think that was her first love was Texas and American politics, and she finally came to love herself at the end. But it took getting sober to really face up to those hard truths within ourselves. And I mean, that's why people, you know, alcoholics or people who are addicts, they drink to desensitize because they feel too much. They're afraid to face those thoughts and those feelings, because then they might not be who they are or they think they are. And usually what happens is once the clarity sets in, they're even more of who they are.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What was her final project? What was the final book she was working on?
It was it is a book. It's called The Bill of Wrongs, and she was co-writing it with her co-author, Lou DeBose. And she was so weak, she couldn't really write. He would go out, she would have these ideas. She would, you know, have her Betsy Moon, her chief of staff, would do research about where to go or these things. And she would know these stories that she would want Lou and she to write about. And she would send him out to do, because she wasn't strong enough to go and interview people and get these stories. And then he would come back and discuss it with her. And she was writing right up until the end. I mean, until she really was not. She was in and out of consciousness, where she would, you know, call him out on, like, she would read something he had written, and then she would call him and say, no, put this here and do this. And she would dictate what she wanted. So the last book is called, and she was still going on C-SPAN up until, you know, maybe a few months before, with a beanie cap on, and she had lost all her hair. And she was still writing 2 columns a week. And dictating them when she couldn't write anymore. And he had to finish the book because she passed. But it's The Bill of Wrongs, and she at the time was very prescient about what was happening as a threat to the First Amendment, which is where we find ourselves right now. She was a First Amendment warrior.
Toward the end of the film, there's this observation, people in small towns in Texas surrounded by a very different way of thinking would say, Molly Ivins made me feel like I was not crazy.
Yeah, that, and wasn't just Texas. It was all over the country, all over the country, where people felt that they were isolated by geography and they were surrounded by people who had a different point of view, a very extreme, maybe far right, you know, point of view. And Molly's column made them feel like exactly that they weren't crazy, that they, what they thought, what they believed in was believed elsewhere. And she gave them courage.
The new documentary by director Janice Engel is called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. Janice, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. This is fantastic, and I loved having our conversation. It really means a lot to me. Thank you.
Thank you. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. We hope you'll subscribe to the podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.